Coming up on Fronteras, U.S. Customs and Border Protection is undergoing a shakeup following intense scrutiny over the Border Patrol's use of force.
More and more often there are cell phone videos from witnesses that put into question whether it was necessary for the officer to shoot and kill those people.
Why the Customs and Border Protection's internal affairs chief was fired and what this could mean for the future of the Border Patrol. You've likely heard of the increasing waves of unaccompanied Latino minors making their way to Texas. After they survive a dangerous journey to get here, what happens next?
We hear stories of children who have witnessed, who have had traveling partners fall off the trains.
Community-based agencies in Texas are stepping up to the plate to help with the children's care. Those stories on Fronteras, first the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras was created through an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations. I'm Crystal Chavez. Here on Fronteras, we've done extensive reporting on the Border Patrol's use of force and a lack of transparency in the agency's investigations. Now, some changes are underway for U.S. Customs and Border Protection. A high-ranking official was fired. Here to tell us more about the shakeup, KPBS border reporter Jill Ruppelgoal. Jill, who exactly was fired and why?
His name is James Tomczyk, and he's the head of internal affairs for U.S. Customs and Border Protection. He's been in that job since 2006, and CBP announced on Monday that they were going to replace him on an interim basis by Mark Morgan, who comes over from the FBI. Now, they didn't say exactly why he was being replaced, but they did release a statement saying that Morgan would be focusing specifically on investigating allegations and complaints regarding the use of force.
You know, one issue we reported on is the Border Patrol's shooting of people who throw rock at agents. Some unarmed people have died in these cases. Tell me more about that rock throwing controversy.
Right. There, according to a recent Arizona Republic investigation, there have been 8 people killed in rock throwing incidents since 2010 by border agents. And in a lot of those cases, actually, families have filed wrongful death suits. In many of the cases, agents have actually shot through the border at people on the Mexico side of the border. And 6 of those cases, some of those have happened in Texas, some have happened in Arizona. At least one of them happened here in the San Diego section of the border. And there's been a lot of scrutiny of these cases. You know, more and more often there are cell phone videos from witnesses that put into question whether it was necessary for the officer to shoot and kill those people. In some cases, there have been accusations by families of the victims that they were not involved in the rock shooting, that they were innocent bystanders. And so this has put a lot of pressure on CBP to really look at how officers are using deadly force in these cases.
Have there been any other problems with Border Patrol that may have led to the firing of this internal affairs chief?
There have been a few things that have come up in recent months, really adding to this scrutiny of Customs and Border Protection. For one thing, the LA Times leaked a report a few months ago from the Police Executive Research Forum. This was an internal review of CBP's use of force. It was quite critical. In some cases, it said it seemed that agents had intentionally placed themselves in front of people trying to flee in vehicles and firing guns. In other words, placing themselves in front of vehicles as a justification to use of force. It also questioned whether deadly force was necessary in some of those rock-throwing incidents. Now, CBP really tried to not have this report get out. After it came out in the LA Times, the ACLU and many journalistic organizations were asking for it. The ACLU ended up suing them a couple weeks back, and they finally released that report about a week ago. At the same time, they released revised guidelines on their use of force, which prohibit agents from firing at moving vehicles or rock throwers unless there is imminent danger of serious physical injury or death to themselves or to someone else. But civil rights groups say this doesn't go far enough. At the same time, an advocacy group, the American Immigration Council, did a bunch of FOIA requests and found on complaints of use of force against border agents, both Border Patrol agents and Customs and Border Protection officials. They found that in many of the cases where there have been complaints of abuse, there is no action taken. So they looked at 109 complaints between January 2009 and January 2012, so a 2-year period. And they found that in 90% of those cases, there was no action taken. Now, they couldn't tell from the complaints how much merit there was. I don't think they got a hold of the actual investigations. But the results of that indicate that there doesn't seem to be a lot of consequences when there are accusations of abuse. So that's another thing that's added a lot of pressure on CBP.
The big news lately is the surge of Latino children from Central America coming to the U.S. alone. Do we know how the Border Patrol has been handling this huge immigration wave?
I mean, there's two things going on, really. There's been a huge increase in the number of Central Americans coming through, mostly through the Rio Grande Valley. And then there's been a huge increase in minors. Now these things are probably related, but there's been a lot of attention, obviously, on the minors because these are unaccompanied children. They don't have a lot of legal protections, and they're alone after these really difficult journeys. And the U.S. government isn't probably equipped to deal with these children yet. In the last week or so, CBP and HHS, Health and Human Services, have been trying to equip some new areas to take these children. So there's a couple military bases that are being sort of refurbished to handle these children while they wait for their immigration court dates. And then at the same time, they're busing these kids to other parts of the country and the adults as well. We've heard reports of overflowing detention centers in southern Texas. I heard recently that they were going to be bringing 500 people from southern Texas up here to California for Border Patrol processing. Now, it's unclear yet. The government hasn't said how many of these people they're letting off on their own reconnaissance. Some people are put into detention while they wait for their court dates if they're not immediately deported. Some people are given a court date to come back and they're let out, basically, to come back on their own. And there's obviously a lot of controversy around that. Some people say, critics say that they may not ever come back to their court dates. But really, the federal government just can't deal with these huge volumes of people right now. This isn't directly related to the children that are crossing over right now, but the ACLU and a couple other groups sent a letter earlier this week to the Department of Homeland Security accusing the department of not following civil rights laws when the agency detains children. They interviewed a bunch of unaccompanied immigrant children who had been detained, and many of them had complaints of abuse. Some of them said that they were hit. Some of them said that they were locked up in very cold cells. These complaints predate this large rush of children that are coming across the border now, but it does bring into question whether or not border authorities are equipped to properly handle these children.
That was KPBS border reporter Jill Replegal. We're now going to take a closer look at what happens to all of these unaccompanied minors crossing the border into Texas once they're here. Local agencies are stepping in to help with the children's care. In San Antonio, Eileen Pace reports a legal immigration assistance center has refocused its mission to help during this crisis.
At the San Antonio headquarters of the nonprofit organization Traíces, or the Refugee and Immigrant Center for Education and Legal Services, six children, who seem younger than their 8 to 11 years, sit in large chairs at a very grown-up conference table. They're fidgety and they're trying to be attentive, looking at the school-sized poster that Hannah Esch shows them with pictures and descriptions of their legal rights now that they're in the U.S.
These children that we have here this morning are from El Salvador, Honduras, and we have two from Belize.
It's hard to tell if the kids understand the information, phone numbers to immigration, instructions to always tell the court if their address changes.
The Know Your Rights presentation does vary some depending on if we're talking to a group of this age or if we're talking to a group of 15 to 17-year-olds, obviously. It's a little bit less detailed, but I think that we try and sort of give it in a child-friendly way.
We usually try to provide the first Know Your Rights presentation between 3 and 10 days of the child's arrival to the program.
Executive Director Jonathan Ryan says these days, Raíces has given up its usual mission of helping all immigration applicants. They're serving adults only in emergency cases right now to make room for the nonprofit's attorneys to assist the 800 children in their system.
That's a population that turns over every 30 to 45 days.
Ryan says the numbers of unaccompanied minors coming into the U.S. have actually been steadily increasing over several years, and communities have been stepping up in a variety of ways.
And this predates the arrival of Lackland or the other military bases. These are group homes to foster care, to converted retirement communities, converted hospitals that are used to provide emergency housing to these children. At these locations, they receive services such as medical, mental health, counseling.
Government officials now say 90,000 Central American children will escape to the U.S. this year. The House Appropriations Committee on Wednesday approved an additional $78 million for fiscal 2015. That starts in September. Congressman Henry Cuellar says the money is earmarked for transporting the children to shelters.
When they're caught down there at the border, the kids are being sent by plane to different parts of the country, whether it's California, whether it's Oklahoma, whether it's Lackland, San Antonio, whether it's Virginia, and they're being flown. So monies are being used for flights, for trains, for buses, and that's what this money's for.
Ryan says the children that do make it to the Raices coverage area in Texas, which is large, going from San Angelo to Waco to San Antonio to Houston, will continue to receive legal services from his organization.
Normally the children are leaving their villages alone or in small groups, and then as they travel along the travel routes, gather together with more children. Many of them travel through Central America and Mexico while riding on the top of trains. And so they gather together in that environment. And it's a perilous journey. We hear stories of children who have witnessed, who have had traveling partners fall off the trains. You're sitting next to someone for several days as the train rolls along, and then you go under a bridge, and on the other side of the bridge, the person sitting next to you is not sitting next to you anymore. They tie themselves to the tops of the trains so that they can sleep without getting thrown off. The fact is that when we started this work a few years ago, every once in a while, we would encounter a child who was kidnapped or trafficked or assaulted or held for ransom en route by a criminal gang or a cartel or the Zetas.
Once in a while.
Once in a while. The reality now is that once in a while we see a kid who didn't go through that.
Eileen Pace, San Antonio.
Keep it here on your public radio station. There's more Fronteras news coming up after a short break. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. This week, the FBI announced a criminal investigation into the Department of Veterans Affairs the day after a bipartisan bill passed the House in Washington calling for more oversight of the VA. The FBI launched its probe a day after three VA facilities in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas were tarred with failing grades in the agency's own audit. The story from Marfa Public Radio's Lorne Madelon.
The VA pummeled by withering criticism, veterans dying waiting for care. Tuesday, the House passed legislation ordering the VA to cover the cost of veterans' care at a non-VA hospital or clinic if that veteran can't get the care at a VA hospital. The legislation passed 426-0. It mirrors proposed Senate legislation co-sponsored by Arizona Republican John McCain. Here's the House bill sponsor, Florida Republican Jeff Miller, on Fox News.
Men got terminal cancer that was not being able to be treated because they were on wait lists. 5,000 men at one time were on a wait list when they had the ability to send them out for non-VA care.
The VA's chief in West Texas and eastern New Mexico, Michael Kiefer, told reporters Tuesday that three facilities in the Southwest will be formally investigated in Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas.
It's not a destination, it's a journey. It's not something we're going to solve and it's going to remain solved.
Kiefer defended the agency's record in Texas, saying that 92% of veterans are seen within 30 days. That's a number challenged by veterans' rights groups. And the VA admits four centers in Texas, among them Dallas and El Paso, rank in the top 10 longest waits for new patients looking for mental health care. Kiefer says the VA has a staffing problem that the agency will address.
So that's, you know, offering recruitment bonuses, retention incentives.
Translation, higher pay. The agency struggles to keep doctors because of relatively low salaries and stressful working conditions.
We're in the process of hiring, what's the right term, recruiter, so that we'll go out to trade events where providers congregate and trying to get the value of working for the federal government out there. And it's a leap of faith that it will pay off, but there's what's the alternative, right?
The El Paso VA, one of the country's largest, isn't on the list of facilities that will be formally investigated. It says 93% of veterans there are served within a month. But Texas Democratic Representative Beto O'Rourke doesn't buy that. He wants to know if there's a policy there that hides or distorts wait times or poor care, echoing a complaint made last year by a VA physician in Phoenix that triggered the scandal. I'm Lorne Madelon in Marfa, Texas.
The Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund has filed a federal civil rights lawsuit on behalf of the League of United Latin American Citizens. It alleges the state isn't doing enough to advance English language learner students in Texas schools. Ryan Poppy reports from Austin.
The Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, or MALDEF, filed a 27-page federal lawsuit in court this week that uses continuing state education reports to show that English language learners are not doing as well in school as other students. MALDEF's attorney, David Hinojosa.
One of them is the state's own English language proficiency assessment, and it shows we're more than one out of every two English language learner children in grades 3 through 12 are not advancing at least one proficiency level in English from one year to the next. That is the expectation. And so when we have more than half of our English learner children not advancing, and especially at the secondary grades where, you know, the rigor is increasing for students, where we have students who have been in English language learner programs for 6+ years, you know, something needs to be done, and that's why this lawsuit was filed.
Hinojosa says that points to a violation of the 1974 Federal Equal Education and Opportunities Act because students are not overcoming their language barriers. He says a lot of this comes from what goes on in the classroom.
The only opportunity they have to learn English is when they're pulled out for 1 hour a day and put in front of a computer. It's supposed to be taught by, you know, an ESL instructor.
Hinojosa says in a school district that mimic this scenario, the dropout rate for ELL students is 1 in 4. He says in many cases, teachers aren't even aware which students are ELL students.
If they don't know who they are, then how are they going to ensure that those students are getting it?
Hinojosa says that some of the problem has to do with the way the Texas Education Agency has responded to the shortage of ESL teachers.
Some of that, we think that the way the state is trying to deal with that is to make the pathway to become an ESL certified teacher less rigorous.
The suit singles out San Antonio's Southwest Independent School District and Northeast Independent School District, but also claims that it's a statewide problem. LULAC is asking a federal judge to declare the state is in violation of federal law and to order the Texas legislature to fix the problem. I'm Ryan Poppy, reporting from Austin, Texas.
Although African-American women are less likely than white women to get breast cancer, they're more likely to die of it. That's in part because they tend to develop breast cancer at a younger age and in more advanced forms. As part of KERA's Breakthroughs Initiative, Lauren Silverman reports on a group of North Texas breast cancer survivors who get together to talk about new research, offer encouragement, and share their journeys.
Welcome, ladies. Good evening. I'm so glad you guys are here.
Once a month, Leslie Williams greets a handful of breast cancer survivors in a room at the Baylor Cancer Center at Irving. It was 5 years ago that Williams, who was only 41 at the time, felt something strange in her breast.
I felt a squishy grape, the size of a grape, and it was painful. And I was like, oh, wait a minute.
After a series of tests, Williams learned it was cancer, triple negative breast cancer.
I had absolutely no clue what that was. For me, hearing that it was triple negative meant it was okay. And every time I did research on the internet, oh my God, it was morbidity. It was death. Always with the tag of African-American women. African-American women. African-American women.
Triple negative breast cancer is more common in African-American women. And I'm often asked why. And the straightforward answer is we're not sure.
That's Dr. Roshni Rao. She's a surgical oncologist at UT Southwestern. She explains triple negative breast cancer is hard to treat because, well, it's triple negative. Most breast cancer cells test positive for certain receptors, like estrogen and progesterone, meaning if you give the cancer cells medications that interfere with those receptors, those cancer cells, they stop growing. Triple negative, on the other hand?
Triple negative breast cancer is one that doesn't have any of those receptors, so we don't have any of those medications to utilize.
That means surgery, chemotherapy, and radiation are, right now at least, the most effective treatments. Leslie Williams has been cancer-free for 5 years, but she made a promise she wouldn't stop talking to women in her community about triple negative breast cancer.
I need to make it safe for us to have that conversation, because culturally we don't talk about it. We just bury our head all together, or we're raised to be superwomen. We take care of everybody. We dismiss our health issues. We put it last until something falls off. I'm trying to change that mindset. You got to take care of yourself.
Friends and family helped Carla Harvey through aggressive treatment for her triple negative breast cancer. She's here in a bright pink silk jacket to give back to other survivors with makeovers and lipstick.
When women are going through the treatment, they need to know that there are other women that have been through the same thing.
Harvey was diagnosed with breast cancer when she was 38 years old. That might sound young, but about a third of African American women who get breast cancer are younger than 50, which is why Dr. Roshni Rao says awareness and early detection are key.
African American women need to be particularly aware of their screening recommendations if they have a family history or even if they don't. And they also need to make sure that they undergo at least exam by a physician every year starting at the age of 25.
In the meantime, researchers like Rao are running clinical trials to try and identify which genes predispose certain women to triple-negative breast cancer. Lauren Silverman, KERA News.
You've been listening to Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and minority communities. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations along the Southwest. You can find the entire audio for this program and past Fronteras shows online at tpr.org under the Programs tab. If you want to share these stories with your friends on social media, there are one-click buttons to Facebook and Twitter. This theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez in San Antonio. Thank you for listening.